The Clare Byrne Show on News Talk
with Aviva Insurance.
My next guest is the voice behind the iconic White Ladder, the timeless hits like Babylon and This Year's Love, but he's enjoying huge success with his latest album, Dear Life, and he's coming back to Ireland this summer, and I'm delighted to be joined by David Gray.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
Welcome back home, I feel I should say.
It does feel a bit like home.
It does feel a bit like that, doesn't it? I mean, you said that Ireland and the response that Ireland had to you initially back then, that it changed your life, the career trajectory.
It's been completely transformative. I think if you're making music, you're just trying to connect heart to heart with somebody. That's the whole point. And that's where it happened here in Ireland from the very beginning with the Century End shows I did at Whelan's. And it's just never, we've never looked back from there. And that relationship has just grown and got deeper and stronger. And I'm a kind of heart-led kind of performer. So Clune and I, way back then, we just poured everything we had into the positiveness that was coming back at us. Mm-hmm. And it kind of created this amazing relationship, which then went on to become a, you know, kind of commercial success, I suppose.
I mean, you're really busy this year looking at what you've done so far, and then the big tour coming up, UK and Ireland, all sorts of dates. I was having a look at it last night, and we'll talk about the Irish date soon. But does success feel different now?
Yeah. I'm very grateful for every positive thing that happens. I think it's finite. Suddenly you realize that how long can I sing like this, do this? It's not going to last forever. And this is pretty amazing. So
you appreciate it more, do you?
100%. I think that's one of the confusing things about success when it really happens and kicks in. Suddenly everything's sold out and it's all getting bigger and everyone's your friend. It's impossible to keep placing the same value on what you're being given, which is a cheering crowd. So at a certain point in your life, you work out the real value of mm-hmm. that. Maybe something makes you realize that you lose it a little bit. And when it comes back, you're certainly not going to forget how important it is.
I was reading back an interview that you did. I think it was after that crazy time where you said you were away in the States. You were missing your family. It's tough, isn't it? That life on the road is tough. It's probably easier to do it now than it was then.
I don't think it gets any easier on the body or the mind, to be honest. You enter a sort of a weird world of exhaustion and adrenaline, and it's the distance from home and your forced proximity to other individuals that you've spent far too much time with in the past makes it a challenging process. How did I word that? That was quite careful.
you did well.
This is the politics show, so I was quite political there.
I caught all of the nuance, though. All of the nuance. People who you mightn't choose to live in close quarters with, but you're forced to. They're all friends, though, right?
Yeah, no, we are. We're a big dysfunctional family, and that's all part of it. There is real loyalty and investment there. We've been playing this music. This is the flesh of my music, my band. But yeah, you've all spent a lot of time in close quarters and going away in the pressure cooker. I wish I could say I can be more chilled out about shows when I'm older. The show is everything and it has to count every second of the show. They're all different. It's a new audience. For me, it's go again. You go again each night. You don't do the same thing you did last night. It's a new show. Mm-hmm. So you have to make it again and feel a new connection and build that from song one till it finishes. It's got to be special. That's what you're there for, to be present on the stage, not just turn up and go through the motions like a sort of jukebox style gig. Mm-hmm. So that's demanding, and I obviously have high standards and they have to meet those standards, and there's always tension, there's tiredness, and then there's high times when it all clicks and you have just the most extraordinary night, which
the joy of realizing this is why I'm doing it.
It's when self dissolves and just you're just left with a wonderful feeling that you were a part of on the stage and everyone in the room was a part of, and it elevates everything. It makes it all worthwhile.
Mm-hmm. Dear Life, I was having a listen to it yesterday with my children. They were very interested. You'd be pleased to hear. But I felt it was reflective, maybe a little spacious. Maybe we'll just have a listen and we'll talk about it then. Here's After the Harvest.
This beat your fist on Adonis, this manus, this Yana. Well, in any case, I know. I see it shining
That's After the Harvest from Dear Life. And as it was playing, David, you were telling me about how that song was made.
Yeah, interesting process, because of course this was lockdown and I sent the track to Clune. I was very excited about it, but we couldn't get the rhythm side working. And he lives in America and he went round to his neighbor's house to record the drums, who's had a recording studio in inverted commas. So that's just,
makeshift.
Obviously he might have had a recording studio, but he certainly didn't know how to sync to the track that we sent him. So we got this kind of chaotic recording back, but Clune really nailed it with the part. And once Clune's drums were on there, we had this kind of thing that felt finished, and that mm-hmm. all that remained was for the strings and the little trumpet parts, the muted trumpet to be put on, which was all part of a massive string session we did at Air Studios, which was super, super exciting and gives it this lavish quality when you hit those emotional choruses. I mean, I love that track. When I'm making a record, there's the odd song will land and I'll think, this is it. This is the key track from which everything else must now relate.
No.
The album, this is the sort of key to the album mm-hmm. is here.
And when you're listening to that, are you saying to yourself, yeah, I'm happy with that, that's what I wanted? Or are you still critical of it?
Of course, critical, yeah. Listening, checking that it's good, that it sounds real. It's the thing about recorded music is when you listen back to it, it's a sort of small version of what you've got in your head.
Mm-hmm.
You can only capture a sort of two-dimensional impression, if you like, of what it was. So when you go live, you hear the whole thing sort of widescreen, for real. The beating heart of the music is right there in front of you. The bass is hitting you in the chest. When you hear it through a tinny little speaker, it sounds like something
different.
So you want to check that it's doing what it needs to do. And the really good recordings do stand up for themselves, even under unflattering circumstances. Mm-hmm. So, yes, you're always checking, always checking.
Do you, I spoke about it being reflective. Do you find it hard to get space in this world? Because it's much busier than it was when you started out. Do you find it hard to find the room?
Technology has stolen space. As much as it's sort of democratized and enabled lots of things, it's also stolen space, because you're just you're constantly attentive to messaging that, you know, it's invasive. And so to really contemplate and really go, allow thoughts to deepen and attenuate yourself to feelings or the natural world or something worthwhile, you've got to break and make some space from that.
Can you do that? I find it really hard to do that.
It's one of the things that's lovely about being on stage. No phones up there. So there's lots of phones in the audience pointing at you.
Does that bother you?
I wish people would just be there more. I think as soon as you start playing This Year's Love or something, up comes the phones. It's weird, but I think it tells you that we've been marketed to the point that we market our own lives back to ourselves,
yeah,
and to each other. So, you know, Saatchi and Saatchi won, hands down. The victory is theirs.
Look at the performance with your eyes, not with your phone.
Well, just be there, just being. Being is at the center of curing all the world's ills, really, in terms of our relation to the environment, nature, and into each other. It's about being aware. So it's hard to be aware when you're being harried and sort of hypnotized by the flashing lights that we have in our hands and the mirrors that are constantly there that also make us much more narcissistic than we even were before. So I think it's a big problem. With this record, we were granted an extraordinary relief from some of modern life's pressures when COVID happened, and for all the terrors of the disease and the people that suffered through it. For most of us, we had an extraordinary opportunity to slow life down and actually look at what it was. What does a fish know about the water in which it swims? Well, we had a chance to actually have a little think about that when we were sort of in our tanks. And and I think that's what deepened a lot of the sort of sentiment and the feeling on the Dear Life record. It was definitely allowed to grow a little deeper because I had more time to think. And mm-hmm. I turned off the creative taps for a while and just tried to be like everybody else in this weird situation. So that's partly the story of the record.
And we're all getting a little bit older. Do you find that it makes you braver, more creative, careless? What are the implications of it? I know you said you appreciated life more on stage because you can see that this lasts for a period of time and then it's going to be gone.
I think it's more important to do things that really matter to you. And that's how it's beginning to govern my use of time. So I write pop songs. I'm doing big This is a big poppy, I think it's a poppy record. We're doing a big tour because these songs can stand up next to all the big hits, which they have to go shoulder to shoulder with during these shows. The shows have a celebratory tone, but I also do more sort of inward looking music and projects. And I have sort of other kind of more esoteric dreams, creative dreams, and I will be pursuing those with vigor and intent, because they're so important to me to extend that part of my thinking out, the width of what I'm doing and the depth of it.
So that's going to be less about commercial stuff.
Well, yeah, rather than just targeting how can we follow this success up with an even bigger tour and, you know, more arena shows or whatever. That's not the way I'm thinking. I'm thinking about what matters to me most in my head. So, and my heart, what's really wanting to be made, and what is it that I really want to do? What's the song I really want to sing? I think that's more what's happening over time, is I'm making more time and being more, discerning about, the democracy of how I spread time and focus across different projects and things. So that's how it's changing.
It's great to have that freedom, because now, you know, artists who are starting out now, even if they have an album that does really well and everybody's heard about it, they're just not making any money, are they?
It's a challenging time. I'm very fortunate to be on the other side of the line, in that I made a success of things before technology took away the idea of a record sale. Yeah. And when the record sale was removed from the music business, all kinds of problems were left in its wake, which haven't really been sorted. What you've seen is the ticket price gets higher and higher because the event becomes everything. And that's more complicated than just not having the records on sale. That's part of the way life has changed. Being at something and showing people you're there has become a really important thing. But it's also had to make up the gap for a lot of artists with where those that the money from your publishing or whatever that physical record sales would have brought in. So the business changed completely and utterly when all that disappeared. And it's still really in a period of readjustment, because the major labels have all readjusted quite happily. They cut all their costs, and now the money's just pouring nicely into the account. But for artists on the sort of breadline of trying to make a small career work, I think it's definitely modifying people's recording ambitions. Just because you can record something cheaply and put it out doesn't mean that's the best thing for that song.
And I thought the gigs would fill the gap, but what I'm hearing from artists who come in here is that they often end up with a bill at the end of a tour.
Well, touring is really expensive. I mean, just look at what's going on right now and right this second with petrol prices and everything else, and the inflationary nature of the instability that's been sort of foisted upon the world by these lunatics that are running the show, in part at least. The sort of fragile nature of our sort of financial picture, and these soaring prices, everything from a tour bus to a this to a that.
Yeah.
Every single part of the package costs more and costs more and costs more. And if you don't sell those tickets, if your new record doesn't quite click with the fans, or there's just too much on that year, they decide not to go and see you, they're going to go and see somebody else, then you've got a problem. And yes, you can lose your shirt. I mean, it's a tough industry. So people make it sound like it's okay. People used to sell records, but now they just go on tour. It's not that simple at all.
And some just do residencies now. We've seen that. Look at the Celine Dion residency just announced in Paris.
Sorry, I should laugh.
And then you have, you know, the Vegas ones.
Yeah.
But they're expecting people to travel very long distances, sometimes halfway around the world, to come and see them rather than they're touring and visiting Dublin, for example, way that you are.
I mean, we've looked at just looking at environmental impact from touring. That's actually the most damaging way of doing it, to be in one place and say everyone else come to me.
Yeah.
From that point of view, you're not freighting your gear around, but you've got all the people
moving.
Which is the big cost, really. Mm-hmm. So I, from that point of view, I think it's interesting. These fashions and fads are interesting. You've got I think what it is now is you've got these mega stars, these Elvis type names, and you put them up on a billboard and you say, hey, you know, and it's a brand that
come to Graceland,
come to Vegas, come to Vegas. We're going to be here for a year. This is it. And they build it around that big artist. And that's sort of, but that's the top sort of luxury end.
That's the top 1%, isn't it?
No, less. I mean, it's the top tiny bit of entertainment, people that can do that. And that are such a sort of Super Bowl halftime kind of stars that can command those kind of situations.
Mm-hmm.
But for the humble musician making a record and trying to make it work, they have to go out and make ends meet in a different way. And those kind of propositions and ideas aren't really something that are going to come their way. So there's all kinds of fads within the industry, which have been very successful. I mean, people are always looking for something novel that will get everyone's attention. It drives the media and suddenly publicity campaign done.
Yeah.
So, and I think that's partly what it is. These sort of the Sphere or whatever it is, you know what I mean?
U2's one in Vegas.
They opened it. But yeah. I mean, it just looks like a headache to me. I don't want to look at jellyfish.
I tend to agree with you. I want to just listen to the music.
It's like,
I heard it was brilliant though.
Yeah,
I
mean, I'm sure it is. It was great. I'm sure it's totally psychedelic and unbelievable, but it's presented as if it's the future of entertainment. That the future of entertainment is really more humble than that.
Community centres.
It's how we make the small gig circuit, which is under so much pressure, work, because that's where the heart of music comes from. And so what are we going to do about that? Who's going to siphon off a bit of profit and help that part out?
Let's have another listen to a track from Dear Life. Yeah, this is Plus and Minus with Tali Ray. Let's hear it.
As you are the plus and minus, sailing by like ocean liners. Do you hear me, boy? Staring to the dim and distant, where it used to be so different. Do you feel me, boy? You can give a man everything he wants. Sit back and watch him disappear, boy.
So how do you feel about collabs?
Yeah, well, I really enjoyed that one. That was with a young singer, Talia Ray, and that just worked a treat. The song needed this extra bit of storytelling, the back and forthness. So, yeah, I mean, I love duets. I mean, collab has become a bit of a thing.
It's a thing. 2026 word.
It's been going on for a while. So there's a lot of duetting, just to one person adding their brand to another. That's a kind of commercial approach too, but I do love the old.
Enjoy it though?
Oh, like if it's, I mean, I love singing with Leanne Rimes and Jolie Holland and Annie Lennox and Talia. So I love the kind of the cross play of the voices, the harmonizing. I love the old, you know, Diana Ross and Lionel Richie kind of stuff.
Yes.
I like these kind of corny things. I like musicals. I like that kind of, it's like you suspend your disbelief in a completely different way. It's like Islands in the Stream. Hello.
Love that song.
Amazing. So,
very
Dolly
high range,
Kenny,
though, Dolly. You ever try to sing along with Dolly? I mean, you obviously can, but you know, her range is extraordinary, isn't it?
A tricky song to sing, that one, because I tried to do it as a karaoke thing and made a complete balls of it. So
I'm kind of glad and comforted to hear that.
Yes, it was a total disaster, if you want to know the truth. I love duetting, and when the song feels right, I'm often putting songs to one side and say, that could work as a duet. I could give that verse there and this bit here, and that would actually make the song a completely different thing, which is what happened with Plus and Minus, a song I'd had for an awful long time. You know, it'd been sort of in the offing for 20 years or something as a chord sequence. And I suddenly found a new way to write it. And then I thought, oh, this is actually a duet. I think this is a duet. So then you have to find that other voice and someone who's going to work. That part, it had very low parts for a woman's voice. As you were, then plus, you had to get down there, which isn't what everyone can do. So you've got to be confident down on the lower register. So that's why Talia just nailed it, because she can get down there.
Tim, we could keep going. And if we got on to politics, we would definitely
be here
till midday. But I want to tell people when you're going to be playing in Ireland. So the 13th of June in
My
Cork.
Birthday.
It's your birthday then?
Yeah.
Lovely. Well, happy birthday. We might talk to you again on that day. Live at the Marquee with the Divine Comedy, which will be fantastic. And again the next day. So you can't do too much on your birthday, because you have to do the show again on the 14th. That's again in Cork. And then on the 17th, Fairview Park, again with Divine Comedy in Dublin, of course. David, such a pleasure to have you in. Thank you. What a lovely chat. That's David Gray.
The Clare Byrne Show
with Aviva Insurance.
Weekday mornings at 9 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.